Hello, it's Kathy Love here. I'm a business coach who helps allied health professionals run powerful and profitable businesses in the disability sector. So no big surprise at all, I like to talk a lot. And now I can share some of the incredible people who crossed my path and the interesting conversations that we have. The Private Practice Secrets podcast is all about harnessing and sharing this collective business know-how, the experience, and the wisdom. My guests are amazing. They're bold, they're brave, and they're honest. There are laughs, and surprisingly, there's often talk of wine. We think you're really going to enjoy these unplugged private practice chats. So come on in, pull up a chair, let's get the conversation started. Good morning, Natasha. Happy International Women's Day.
Yes, I think it's very exciting we're talking on International Women's Day. Don't get me started on that topic.
Well, I thought I might just get you on your soapbox from the get-go. So for everybody listening, Natasha Hawker is the Director of Foyer Matters, and she's also an author and a speaker and a trainer and a soapboxer for international women's issues. So I want to hear what your current soapbox issue is.
Look, I think it's, you know, it's an interesting one. I have two daughters and a son, and I think we've come a long way, but I still think we've got so far to go. And I keep getting shocked by information that's released. And I recently heard Gina Davis being interviewed on the 7:30 report about how Thelma and Louise as a movie basically transformed her life. And she realized that women weren't empowered and they weren't great role models in popular culture like movies for people to actually aspire to be like that. And she actually started an institute, and she does a whole lot of research. And apparently our gender diversity in movies in Australia and the US and the UK is 0%, and we're just not well positioned. And so we don't have great role models for our girls. And the lovely part of that, or the scary part of that, was my daughter just applied to be a leader at her school. And I was amazed at the process that she had to go through to be either a school captain or a prefect. And they had to do speeches and all sorts of things. But she only has a small class. And of that class, 35 in the class, 11 girls put their hand up and said, I want to be a leader. I want to be school captain. I want to be vice captain. Only 7 boys. And they made these amazing speeches. And I thought, what happens to those 11 girls that actually think they've got the skills and the attributes and the willingness and the desire to be a leader by the time we get to boardrooms, when we're so poorly, you know,
represented
in boardrooms? So that's my soapbox, and I've written a blog on it, and I do think we need to change, and I think we need to make changes more proactively, and I think we need to get the guys involved in that change as well. And there are some leaders that in the business community that are trying to make that change, but we need more, and we need it to happen more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Round of applause from my end here. I saw this quite cute looking Facebook post this morning, but I persisted and it got more and more and more serious. It's essentially a mother and daughter standing in front of a bookshelf of children's books, and they pull out the ones with male characters and they pull out the ones with girl characters that don't speak. And it ends up that there is this tiny percentage, I think it's under 20%, something like 11% of children's books have a strong, assertive female role model. And of course, I started discussing this with my husband this morning, and it didn't end very well. International Women's Day didn't get off to a very good start in my house. The only highlight was that our cleaner who's here today is a guy, and that sort of was a bit of a giggle. But it kind of winds right back to girlhood. And I think there's a lot of gender work to be done for both right from the early get-go.
I totally agree. And in my conversation with my daughter this morning over breakfast, I told her that about Gina Davis. And I said, so what movies do you know that have a female strong role model? And she could think of two, Annie and Rogue One. And I said, but surely there are more. And she said, I can't think of them. But Mummy, that's she almost had, that's the way it is. And I said, but aren't you concerned that you can only, you know, give me two names of two movies where there's a strong female role model? And I'm sure there are more, but I think we didn't even know that that was happening to us when we were growing up. That was just the way it was. And I think part of what we need to do to empower women is actually to bring this conversation to the front and actually have these conversations so people go, actually, yeah, that's right, and not just take it as that's the status quo.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And what in this little Vimeo that I was watching, it was about they pulled out all the princess books, all the books about princesses and about girls waiting to be rescued. And something like 76 books just came flying off the shelf. And, you know, that was sort of stuff that I grew up with. But I also had that rounded off very promptly by going to quite a contemporary modern girls' school. I didn't realise that that's what it was until years, decades later. But, you know, we were given every opportunity to do whatever and however and to speak for ourselves. And, yeah, I mean, I guess the school I went to raised a cohort of what could be labelled bossy girls, aka leadership. Yeah, leadership skills and, you know, future entrepreneurs. And, yeah, there's doctors and poets and philosophers and allied health professionals and cancer researchers and writers, artists, all sorts of people came out of my cohort. And what I don't know is whether that percentage of creativity and chutzpah is any different to any other cohort, but it was certainly the environment I grew up in.
Fabulous.
Back in the 70s.
Fabulous.
So thank you for your soapbox. I'm right there with you. Step over. There's room for both of us on that one.
We need more.
We need more. And I guess by way of a segue, a lot of my tribe and a lot of the people that I talk with on a day-to-day basis are women. Mm. In fact, virtually all of my clients, all of the allied health business owners that I work with are women. And so they've kind of got this juggle going on that is really relevant in the coaching skills, because often that home-work balance isn't always quite the way they want it. So you also work with a lot of small and medium business owners. What are the stories that you hear around perhaps the women's issues, but also about the employee matters as well?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think one of the challenges, and it just is, again, part of life. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, you are going to have a juggle if you've got kids. And, you know, it's that old case that women are called mumpreneurs, but you don't ever hear about dadpreneurs. And it really gets me annoyed when I hear men business owners say things like, oh, I've got to babysit the kids. Well, there's no babysitting about it. You're actually just looking after your own kids, and it's shared duty. And I have to say up front here, I have a very equal relationship with my husband, and in many ways he actually does more of the caregiving for our kids than I do. But I think for business owners in general, female business owners, there is incredible flexibility by running your own business, but there are challenges to that. So you work longer hours, but I always make the joke that I have a very important meeting at 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and it's my kids' assembly. And if any one of them getting something or presenting or whatever, we are there, both my husband and I, and that's one of the advantages of running your own business. I think the other advantage for our kids is actually teaching them about business. You know, our kids come in and they actually work in the office, and they put stamps on envelopes, or they wrap books, sometimes come out and you don't even realize that they're learning this stuff by osmosis, but they'll come out and say things like, Mom, how was that prospective client meeting today? You know,
and words of babes.
Exactly. You know, this is coming from an 11, 10 or a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old. So I think that the business influences that, both good and bad, you know, when you go through those really tough times, and we absolutely did, it does influence them as well. So I think there's a continual juggle, and I think particularly female business owners have to be exceptionally well organized, and they have to be able to flex what they need to do. And I think there's still a lot of guilt there, Kathy. I have to say, you know I travel quite a bit with my business, and I always have that, you know, the kids will say, particularly my middle daughter will say, you're going away again, Mummy. I don't like it when you're away. And so you're juggling with that as well. And I don't think that happens so much at the male side of things.
That's right. One of my favorite books that I still jump into, I don't know if you've read it, it's by Annabel Crabb. I could almost reach to the bookshelf and show it to you, Why Women Need a Wife and Men Need a Life. And to the best of her ability, she discusses what the differences and the similarities and what each gender kind of needs to do to make it a little more wholesome and a little bit more palatable and successful and joyful, I guess, for everybody. So
yeah, it's interesting. I worked
shout out to that book on today.
Yeah, I'd love to read that. I haven't read it. I think she's fabulous. I do remember, because I had a corporate life prior to running Employee Matters, and I remember in our professional services firm, we had women who proactively opted out. They realized that the career trajectory to partner was not viable if they wanted one, a happy long marriage in most cases, and two children. It just, unless you were incredibly wealthy, you couldn't balance it because of the amount of childcare you would require to be able to do that. So we had this massive drop off just when they were hitting their absolute strides as fabulous managers. They just went, you know what, I can't do that.
Yeah, I'm always making a whole lot of noise about the business owners I work with actually investing in themselves and permission to purchase expertise and coaching or instruction or books or what have you, because I see that mental relief, if you like, of being confident and capable in your management role that actually eases up the organization and frames up those moments when you say no because you've got that Friday 2 o'clock commitment.
Yeah.
And there's this funny relationship between kind of investing in yourself, getting your management mojo going, feeling more confident, capable, and running a business that gradually ticks without you so that you do have that chance to revisit all the reasons why you went into self-employment in the first place, which is about the flexibility and doing it your own way and being innovative and collaborative as well. So I see some of my clients and some of the stories I hear, they sometimes drown in the management side of it. And I kind of ache for that. I ache for that. I remember and I know what that's like.
Yeah. Look, I think management is tricky and very few people actually, even if you do a management degree, you're actually taught how to manage. And in my almost 23, 24 years of doing HR or being an employee expert, it's fascinating. And I keep saying I won't be shocked, but I still get the occasional shock. And the issue that I think where it comes down to, Kathy, is that to manage people takes a significant proportion of your week. And we give people the title of manager. They may be practice managers in your case, but they have a technical job to do. And we don't allow them the one day a week or 2 hours a day that it is going to take them to really nurture, develop, manage, grow their team. And that is one of the biggest problems. We actually just don't factor in that managing people is a very time-consuming event and it requires regular and frequent and, you know, the ability to flex up and flex down if, you know, if there are dramas happening in the workplace. And so you need to actually factor that management time in.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else that we've talked about that kind of springboards off that is this fear of, oh no, I'm going to take all of that back, is that one of the main factors is for the people I work with is when they want to grow their business, there is this fear of HR and there is this fear of engaging contractors or casual employees or part-timers incorrectly and that they'll be sued or it won't go right. It won't go well for them as business owners, but it also won't go well for their clients and the other people signing on. And this is something we've talked about a little bit and I'd love to hear a little bit more. I've had a sneak peek under the hood of your lovely program and I'm really curious to hear if you hear that as well and what Employee Matters does to kind of support the green peas, the green pea management drivers.
Yeah, great question. I think for any business owner, and I hear this consistently, that bringing on that first employee is one of the biggest decisions that they will make. It's also one of the riskiest decisions they'll make because you need to get the timing right and you need to get what that individual is going to do correct as well. We actually, and as a result of me coming across this time after time after time again with business owners who were just ready to bring that first employee on, we actually developed a little tool, and I'm going to probably muck up the name, but it's called something like When is the Right Time to Hire? And I think it's available on our website, but I'll send it to you so you can put it in your show notes. But essentially, it's an activity that individuals or business owners can take themselves through to work out when is the right time to hire? Can they afford it? And the second is, what do they actually get that individual to do? So I think doing an exercise like that to actually, you know, work through a framework to work out whether now is the right time for you and then more importantly, what they do. I think you are always going to be limited. If you do not grow your business with people, you're never going to grow your business. There are only so many practice hours you can see clients. So your income, unless you have a great product that sells without you, is always going to be limited if you don't build a team under you. But what you do need to absolutely get better at is recruiting. And I mean that in the full sense of the word. It is around making sure that you understand what the recruitment process is. You do things like background checks and reference checks, and that also you build your interview skills. So you as an interviewer absolutely need to know what's a technical interview, what's a behavioral interview, what's a cultural fit interview. You need to understand that you talk 20%, listen 80%, you need to document it well, and so on. So they're all the things I think as a business owner you can do, but you can absolutely do it and you must do it. And it's a skill you will develop. And I always use it, the analogy, it's like filling your toolkit bag, and it's a skill. And that questioning technique, that probing questioning technique, will not only help you in interviews, but it'll help you draw out from your team what information you need, and you know when you need to drill down to a particular issue and what's happened. So I think they're the things that I would suggest to business owners, but you know, think through the numbers and think through what you're actually going to get them to do.
Yeah. The planning, I completely agree, is important, but sometimes there can be some analysis paralysis and the planning whirlwind continues and you can't actually circuit break your own thinking to sort of make a decision. So that tool sounds really interesting. I haven't seen that one before, but my working memory is just exploding with what you just said. And what I heard in there was three different types of interviews, sort of a technical, a behavioral, and what I'll call a cultural one. Mm-hmm. Are you sort of saying that they're three separate interviews, or are you really encouraging people to have questions that nail those three components in one interview?
It's the latter, Kathy. I think as a minimum, every individual, this is your baby, this is your business. You wouldn't let somebody walk in off the street and start sitting down and dealing with your patients. So you need to make sure you do a very thorough assessment and review of their skills. So we always say two interviews. And the latest thinking on this is you can teach to a certain extent technical. So that's your secondary, because if they've got the degree and you'll go down that and investigate that and make sure they've got the right qualifications. But first and foremost, they could be the most technical, wonderful person in the world, but if they're not a right fit for your business and they don't have the right behaviors, they're never going to work. So I would always suggest your first interview would probably be more of a cultural fit and behavioral. So what I mean by that, with a behavioral interviews assess past performance indicates future performance. So if I say to you, Kathy, tell me about the most difficult candidate client you ever worked for in your practice, what happened and what did you do? What made that person a difficult client? And you give me a brief overview or synopsis, and then I'll go, take me to that first meeting. What were you thinking going into that meeting? What did you do? What did you say? What did you feel? Can you give me an example? What was the outcome? Can you see how I'm drilling down? And I'll almost be like a fly on the wall, and you will answer me, and watch, the story just implodes if they haven't actually done it. But you will give me all these things, and I'll actually start seeing behaviors pop out. So I'll see Kathy had bias for action because she knew this was going to be a tough client. So what she actually did was sat down and planned for that session with that client. And then at the end, she did follow-ups and she, you know, how she dealt with the client when the client got angry or whatever. So you'll see those behaviors come out. So that's a behavioral interview. It is a specialist technique and it takes practice and you need to follow a very structured framework, but they're very powerful because I know, having interviewed for sort of 10 years, probably 7 years before I learned that technique, I used to think I was pretty good at getting a match before I did that. Once I had behavioral, I much more successful. Mm. The cultural side of it is, are they going to fit your culture, the look, smell, and feel of your business? Are they going to want to work with you at 11 o'clock at night just because you've got a massive deadline and you know that that's what needs to happen and they're bought into your business and they want you to succeed? So are they a cultural fit? So there are some great questions about, tell me about a time when you worked with your favorite boss. Why were they your favorite boss? Tell me about the favorite team that you've worked for in the past. Why did that make that such a great experience? So you can see you can start to narrow down on culture.
Yeah, very, 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 very nice. And I guess that last part, that cultural part, that is probably what I hear described as it felt right or it felt like a good match, and that gut reaction. Mm-hmm. And whilst I'm a big believer in fate and the gut reaction, I also think that there's some unexamined process sitting in there, and we probably both know who sort of talks about that sort of quote. So I think it's really good to almost over-prepare for an interview but underplay it.
Yes.
And to, I love your notion of the percentage of listening. I probably need to issue an apology to everyone I have ever interviewed in the last 20 years, but I've got better and better at it over the years. I think every single interview I've ever done has been better and better. And I learned a really interesting lesson from a kindergarten teacher, I'm going to say 7 years ago. And she said, talk less and say more.
Yeah.
And I've tried to apply that to many parts of my life. Some family members probably haven't noticed enough of a difference. But it's just that being really, really crisp and succinct about what you're asking and really knowing why you're asking it.
And I think with your preparation comment there, Kathy, you should have the questions pre-prepared and in your document. And that's got one of the things we've got in our toolkit. But not only that, you should actually ask the same questions to each of your candidates, because otherwise you can't compare. If you ask Cheryl one thing and George another thing, you can't actually compare them accurately. So you will probe off and there'll be slightly different questions. But for the most part, your core questions should be identical for each candidate that's going for that particular speech pathologist role for our given
set. Yeah, that's great advice, because we're all, as allied health professionals, we are genetically wired to be people. And we're often really, really curious, and we'll disappear down rabbit holes and into stories and who knows who. And what we end up doing as the interviewer is losing the frame and losing the hold and the hand in the conversation, and it gets too casual too quick. And I have a hunch that that actually kind of sets up your brand in a way as a manager as well. And you've actually got to rework and reposition yourself sometimes, even within the course of 5 or 10 or 45 minutes. That's to actually pull back the hold on who's got what.
Yeah, and one of the things we highly recommend is a tool called Harrison's, and our clients absolutely love it. It's called Harrison's Assessment. And the reason why they love it is you would have heard of DISC or Myers-Briggs.
Yeah.
You know, extrovert, introvert, have a guess which one I am. It's a pretty easy guess. But the reason why I love Harrison's is it actually maps them to a particular role, so to a speech pathologist role or to a psychologist role. So if I was doing a Harrison's Assessment on you, Kathy, and I'm bringing you in as a speech pathologist, you would do a 20-minute online assessment, and it actually gives you a suitability indicator. So it'll say, Kathy is a 90% fit to being a speech pathologist. And not only that, here are all the traits that she has that are mandatory for a speech pathologist right through to desirable. But the brilliance of the tool is, guess what? To have that information to go, Kathy's an extrovert, Kathy loves public speaking, attention to detail, not so good, you have that information straight away. And so you can actually manage them to optimize their performance from day one, rather than learning about that stuff over the first 6 weeks or 6 months that they're with you. You eventually get that stuff, you know, they don't like typing or whatever it is, or they're not so good with their notes. But this gives you that information day one. So you actually manage them effectively from then.
And that's invaluable when you've got a bit of a close tie, if you like, when you've got two or three really good candidates and you're trying to get leverage out of their personalities in terms of who's going to be a bigger fit. You've actually got some numbers almost to, make a call on. Oh, yeah. That sounds really good. I must have a little bit more of a read of that.
I'll send you a sample and we can do it on you and see what you think.
Oh, no, I don't know about that.
we'll do you against an entrepreneur.
But imagine the idea that managers and future employees are actually profiled, and that applicants can kind of almost choose and get the heads up in terms of what it might really be like. Maybe that would save a whole lot of drama.
Mm-hmm.
So if I kind of come to your front door of your office, who's in there? Who's under your roof?
So great question. When we started Employee Matters, I'd actually worked remotely. I worked for, as I said, a professional services firm. And so I had been working remotely, occasionally from the office, occasionally from home since 2000, when no one did it. You know, they were just a technology company and they had the ability. It was a dial-up through your phone and went dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, took a while. But you could work remotely. When we started Employee Matters, we didn't have any money, like most small businesses. And so I decided to start the business remotely. So we have 10 in our team, but they either work from home or the client site. Having said that, we have an office, which is, I don't know, I usually ask Mark how big our office is. He's just walked in. But essentially, you walk through the front door and there are three desks, a bar that's been turned into a coffee area, but occasionally there is champagne that comes out of there.
See, I told you one would be mentioned. 20 minutes in, we did well.
You did. And there's actually one of these is a tip for your business owners. We have, I love Verve, and every time we hit a milestone, my husband and I will crack a bottle of Verve and celebrate, and then I put a label on it as to what that Verve signified.
Wow.
So I now have 5 bottles up there, and they planning on getting a lot more, but at the moment there's 5 bottles on the bar, and each one, and you forget quickly what that was, and I'll go and read it and go, oh yeah, that's when we did that. Yeah. So that's just a tip, and I know.
Oh, I like it.
Love wine.
But may you have an ever expanding shelf.
Exactly. It's going to have to turn into the TARDIS. But essentially there are 3 desks in the office plus a meeting desk in the middle. My husband and business partner, Mark, and I are here pretty much all the time, and our spare desk, Mondays we usually have 4 people in the office because we have our exec meetings, and then the spare desk, people come and go. You know, sometimes our team wants some company and they'll just come in and work for the day, or if we're working on a project, they'll come in and work for the day.
Yeah. So what are you most proud of about Employee Matters?
Oh, good. I was going to say personally or privately, that we haven't gone under. We went through very tough times and we almost went out the back door. We've worked incredibly hard. We've learnt a lot. We've done a lot of education. And I think we're just a lot more astute than we were when we started. We didn't know what we didn't know. Having said that, Kathy, I'm a great believer that most entrepreneurs would never start their business if they actually knew how hard it was and how easy it was to go out the door, because I think you have to be resilient and you have to be a born optimist to actually do it.
Yeah, and just so persistent.
Yeah.
Dog with a bone, insanely exactly. Persistent. And yeah, I guess also just being able to keep in mind the end game. And I've been a huge fan of buying in the expertise, hopefully ahead of, I try and build people into my future that I think I will need later on. Mm. And I've got a business coach at the moment who's just got the future out in front and got the spotlight on it. Man, that helps to have that shared vision with somebody else as well.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think one of the things that we've changed is I now have stuff up, and another divulging of a secret, I actually worked out of our bedroom for 2.5 years. And a friend of mine who's actually a psychologist, because you guys might get this, said to me, Natasha, there are 2 things you should be doing in your bedroom. And working isn't one of them. But I actually think that whole piece around environment versus productivity is a big thing, because it was the first thing I saw when I woke up and it was the last thing I saw when I went to bed. And there was this confusion state between this is where I work and where I get inspired, and I had one sort of thing up on the wall, where now my office, I'm surrounded by my business plan and my team charter and, you know, my Kanban wall, and I've got all that stuff around me, and my whiteboard, which has got all that stuff on it. So I'm continually being reminded what the end game is, to your point. And I can go and look at my calendar and all of that sort of stuff, which keeps you focused on what you need to do.
Yeah, big fan of a supportive environment. One of the comments I often get from clients when we're Zooming and Skyping is the plants I have in the background, and I have all these other plants. And I can't believe how much water I drink every day, but essentially probably half of it goes on the plants.
Yeah.
That environment dictates performance. Well, and I had years running my office in the bedroom as well, and the flipping lights would be blinking at night.
Yeah.
And I would wake up first thing, last thing, and I really didn't want at that point to have my office on the dining room table, because that's where we ate and played and built cubbies and all the rest of it. So it had to go somewhere. But as soon as I possibly could, at the expense of many, many square meters of billable space, I had an office out of home. And that was pivotal. I felt like a boss.
It's fascinating. And when I was researching to write my book, I went and interviewed a lot of female entrepreneurs who were my target market for what we do. And I was immediately shocked by how many of them had personalized their offices. When you go into a guy's office, it's white walls. And if they've got one plant, it's one plant. That's it. Where the women I'd go in, it was a bright red wall or a pink office, or, you know, it was all color-coded. And what I loved about that was they hugely personalized their office. And it was part of their identity, came through the business. And I think that's an enormously powerful thing. And I would encourage everybody to do that, because you spend so much time there too. You want to be in a space that inspires you and makes you want to create. And, you know, you spend a long time there.
I do, and you do. And it's really nice to be able to procrastinate from time to time and change the artwork around or move things around or clean off the whiteboard. And I find that I use my office space very, I'll use the word therapeutically. I can sit outside, I can work on the couch, I can have clients here, I can store, file, delete, and get a lot of movement as well, which really helps my thinking rather than being crowded or feeling guilty that I'm, you know, hiding in the corner of the house or something like that. So I'm just about to try and reach over and get your book. It's not going to be particularly useful for people listening, but I can at least hold it up and, flick through the pages. What's in there? I only got it last week, and I must confess I didn't get all the way through it on the weekend, despite my really good intentions. What's in it and what drove it?
Yeah, so basically my view is that business owners are the hardest working people in Australia. They work hard. I make the joke, I used to work for a professional services firm and I thought I worked hard. I've never worked as hard as what I work for this boss sitting in the chair and with me right now. So I wanted to build, what I realized was there was no, other than textbooks, HR textbooks, which I studied at uni, there were no guides on how to do HR in Australia, how to run your employees in Australia. And there were bits on being a manager and bits on change management, but nothing around the employee relations landscape. So what I did was I built the book off 9-Step Employee Lifecycle, which is our methodology, which is assess, hire, manage, policy, wellbeing, training, engagement, measurement, and exit. And so what I've done is developed a book that business owners, when I wrote it, I actually put a sticky note on my computer saying I wanted to become a dog-eared companion for business owners, where they literally pick it up and go, oh, I have to have one of those difficult, horrible conversations that no one wants to have about somebody turning up late all the time. Or I have somebody who's got to go on jury duty. How do I manage that? You know, do I have to pay them? Do they get paid? Or, you know, and essentially it boiled down to three things. I wanted to help business owners hire better, manage better, and if required, fire better, and keep them out of Fair Work and keep them out of unfair dismissal cases. So that is it in a nutshell. So it's written for business owners in language, I think, that is not HR speak. It is written to help a business owner manage their employees, but increase their productivity and leverage them. You pay for these resources. Now let's maximize their productivity. Even things like that, most business owners don't even know how to measure productivity. So all the formulas are in there to measure attrition and productivity so that you can actually have a direct correlation to what your employee costs are.
It's incredibly readable and incredibly practical, and the structure of it is absolutely spot on. I wish that I'd have had this book probably 15 years ago, saying. And I'm a big fan of start as you mean to proceed. And if you're going to build your team and grow, and if you've got that mindset, then you need to engage the advice and structure and the belief and do it properly right from the get-go. So I see this as just ideal for business owners who are looking to bring on maybe the next couple of people. They may have somebody already, but are feeling a little nervous about it. So yeah, great framework. Really well done.
And I think the title of it, it's funny, it either attracts attention or people are like a bit icky with it, but it's called From Hire to Fire and everything in between. And the reason why I called it that was I saw that's what business owners had to do. They had to be able to hire well, and if required, they had to be able to exit without getting themselves into trouble with the law. But it's everything that's in between that is the complex stuff. And we have a complex employment relations landscape in Australia. And unfortunately, ignorance is not a defence, and you need to know it. And they're losing patience because Fair Work's been in 7 years and they're like, you guys have had time.
And despite the best intentions and some of the stories I hear from allied health business owners, they're having a go at writing their own HR policies. And I can't even bear to look at your face. Oh, there you go. There. As I say this, and you really, really rammed it home in my mind a couple of months ago when we did another piece of work together, was that you cannot write your own HR policy. You really have to purchase advice, purchase the product. Because my understanding is it's an ever-changing landscape and your policies and procedures need to be squeaky clean and right up to date. And I hear my lawyer's mind on my shoulder saying the devil is in the detail.
You're absolutely right. And I think one of the things that I would say, two things here around policies, you know, for example, classic one that everyone says to me, isn't it three strikes and you're out? As long as I've done two verbal and a written warning, I can get rid of them. Well, that's old legislation. That doesn't exist anymore. So that's a classic example of something that used to be the case that's not the case anymore. And if you have policies, you must follow them. If you get caught out not following your policy and say, for example, there's a grievance procedure and you chose to ignore what that grievance was, then you're going to get yourself into trouble. And the other thing is their policies are there to protect you and they're there to protect your employees. And, you know, I took ages to write those and I had, you know, postgrad in employment relations and we still review them all the time because legislation does change. But my point around that is that, you know, from a, if you have a policy, you must follow it. And, you know, they're written in a way that people can understand them. And the other thing there is that what this does is protect you as a business owner. So say, for example, you have a code of conduct that says it is not appropriate for you to turn up 15 minutes late for every one of your appointments or run 15 minutes late all day, pushing all of your people back. That is not appropriate. That's not how we behave. So then you can actually, in that performance management conversation, direct them to the code of conduct that says you must run on time and be professional. So now you have an anchor from which to manage their performance. It's not just, I just made it up today. That's why you have to do it.
And that it's part of your interview process and your onboarding process. And it's part of your, we call it clinical supervision. And I really want to change that wording. I'm trying just one conversation at a time because the allied health business owners that I work with and hear and write to are really comfortable in that clinical supervisory role. But I think there's room to change the title and bring in the customer service and bring in the HR compliance as well. So I don't know what we're going to call this thing, but it's just in my lifetime, it is going to change from clinical supervision.
Well, while you talk about that, my big bugbear is staff. I think that's a dreadful term. It's very blue collar and it's very, to back on my soapbox, it's very blue collar, Kathy, and it's very them and us. I am the boss. You are my staff. It's see how it immediately has that distance. Just changing the language to be a team.
Team, yeah.
Oh my God. Staff or team? Which do you want to be a part of?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there are better words out there. And guess what? In the world we live in, you can make it up. You know, I've seen somebody be called the chief happiness officer.
Yes.
And their job.
Chief daydreamer.
Chief Jay, you know, the strategic stuff. We don't have to have those big, long, stuffy titles, but we do need to think of things that are going to inspire our team. And again, it forms part of that culture piece. And so, yeah, I would encourage every one of your listeners not to use the word staff. Very antiquated, old school. Let's find a great word, which is about inclusion and is about us all working together to get a better result.
Yeah, with you. Do you have a suggestion for what we could swap in for clinical supervision? Just putting you on the spot there.
You are. And I talk about that because I've that other one because I've had a lot of time to think about it. I don't think one of my things I'm not so good at is creative stuff on the spot. I think it needs to talk to efficiency. So what you're trying to do is improve the efficiency and the customer experience or your client experience. So maybe something like your client experience officer or something around that. You know, one of the things that I always am about taking corporate best practice and applying it in a way that makes commercial sense to small business. So they are basically looking to make customers at the center of everything they do. That is what corporate world are trying to do. At long last, they've gone, you know what? It's all about the client. If the client isn't happy, then we're not going to do great work. So anything that you can do to improve your customer experience is going to help you. And that's what I think, you know, that would be what I would be thinking to do.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll just keep it as work in progress.
Yep.
Work is in progress. And I guess if we shift the mindset around coaching our team in more than clinical service delivery, I think that will be a first step. And I guess at each organization, they will all call it something a bit different anyway.
And that's fine. It's got to work for you and your business.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely. So at the risk of being here all day or the risk of you not even answering the question, can I throw you the curly one that I get asked quite a bit and we've discussed? And that's about this contracting, casual employee, part-time employee bit.
Yeah.
And we haven't got all day. So
that's all right. We won't. But I'm just showing Kathy my hairs on my arms. See what
happens. Oh, did they stick up?
They stick up. So the reason why that happens is that independent contractors, to me, are the riskiest way to hire someone. There are three ways you can hire someone. Permanent.
Tasha, I think we need to premise this as your opinion and what you stand for, and that everyone needs to kind of think it through, but continue.
Yeah. No, absolutely my opinion, and by all means, get a second opinion or get some legal advice. Essentially, there are three ways you can hire someone: casual, independent contractor, and permanent. Permanent employee is where they work permanent, full-time or part-time, so 38 hours as a full-time. Anything under 38 hours is what's deemed to be part-time. And they are entitled to get 10 days personal leave a year to use for them or their family, 4 weeks annual leave a year, and they earn long service leave at the rates relevant to the state they live in. And they have access to unfair dismissal legislation and so on. A casual employee is a much more flexible arrangement. And a casual employee, they tend to be used where there are peaks and troughs in business. I usually use the example of McDonald's. They don't know what shifts they're going to have from one week to the next. A casual employee only requires them to give you 24 hours notice and you to give them 24 hours notice. They have to be paid a minimum rate of pay, and there must be a 25% loading put on that to cover the fact that they don't qualify for personal leave or long service leave. In other words, if they don't work, they don't get paid. Casuals are great in the sense that they're a low-risk way to hire people. Some awards, and you need to check the awards, have a click-over clause where if somebody has been casual for 12 months, at that 12-month mark, they automatically turn into a permanent employee. So that is something to watch out for. One of the few ones it doesn't work in is, for example, the fast food award, where you can do McDonald's casuals forever and a day. Then we come to independent contractors. Independent contractors, most of your listeners will have heard of the old 80-20 rule that doesn't exist anymore. There are two reasons why independent contractors are risky. The ATO don't like them, and nor do Fair Work. The ATO don't like them because they don't pay tax, pay-as-you-go tax, PAYG. They pay it at the end of the year. So they don't get their regular reoccurring income. The reason why Fair Work don't like them is because they're not protected by minimum entitlements, such as protections under long service leave and personal leave and annual leave. Independent contractors, though, the reason why it's complex is that they have to meet a test, and the test is multifaceted. So things like an independent contractor can't wear your uniform. An independent contractor can't have your business card with their name on it and your logo on it. An independent contractor must bring their own equipment to work and use their equipment. An independent contractor is meant to be used for a bespoke end-to-end piece of work, discrete piece of work, and how they deliver that is up to their own way of doing things, including they could actually give that work to someone else without your permission and bring that person into your business to do the speech pathology session. Now, that's usually the one that gets people. And they don't have to do it the Kathy Love way. They can do it whatever way they want. Now, I imagine most of your people would fail one or more of those tests. The risk, if you choose to keep using an independent contractor, is a fine of up to $54,000 for breaching the Fair Work Act and sham contracting. And the sting in the tail is that they would, if they found out, for example, Georgia has been using an independent contractor 3 days a week for the last 3 years, then they would come in and say, she is prorated salary. She has earned 3/5 of her annual leave. And let's assume she had 3/5 of her sick leave and she took half of it, then you now need to pay her out for that leave and that personal leave, and you need to have accrued long service leave for her. So $54,000 is a big figure. Would they come in necessarily and dock you straight away? And then the answer would be no. So the fine is up to $54,000. Now, I'm not suggesting you would necessarily cop the full whack of it, but legally you could. And so it is an area I do know, and I've had this from one of the top law firms, is that the ATO and Fair Work are going after the health industry this year. They tend to do industry by industry. So I do think it is a risk area. Now, again, all of my advice to a certain extent, Kathy, is as the business owner, here are your risks. You choose which risk you want to take. But I would suggest there are other ways to bring employees onto your business. And I think if you keep going down the independent contractor route, that is the riskiest instrument from which to hire somebody.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hearing a growing trend of the casual employment route, which is fascinating. And it tells me that people are thinking around the corners and getting advice. And I guess that's the take-home message from our conversation today, isn't it? That don't let that great big kind of fear of being sued or fear of getting it wrong block the growth hopes and dreams you have, but to get in touch with people who know that stuff and know it inside out, upside down, and are up on the current legislation so that you understand it. And you need to be pretty fluent in it as the business owner. You need to be completely articulate in your interview, in your advertising, in your branding, and in your people management and your team leadership stuff. So
absolutely, it can be done. You just need to invest in it.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. Best to learn it.
Yep, absolutely, and buying that great support. So how about you give a shout out to your business and your website, and then it looks as though you're onto the next awesome thing. So shout out about what you do.
Yeah, so Employee Matters, we help small business grow faster than ever before through their employees. You can find us at www.employeematters.com.au. My book is called From Hire to Fire and Everything in Between. You can buy that on Amazon, or you can buy it in Dimmicks or Good Bookshops, or you can buy a PDF copy for $5. So you can get those off the website. I would argue every business owner needs to have a copy of that in Australia. And I think that's really, really is a great starting point for all your listeners. If they get that book and read that, that is what it's designed to do, is to help them navigate employees. We have a team. We are available to come in and do one-offs, or we come in regularly and play your HR manager or your employee expert role as and when you need us. But we do lots of great blogs. There's loads of checklists on the website that are all free. So by all means, stalk us on our Facebook or join us on Facebook or our website, and I'm sure you'll be able to get lots of tools and tips from that.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for squishing in this conversation. I'm sure there'll be many more to come, and wishing you an incredible International Women's Day. But I also want to wish you the next bottle of Verve as coming sooner rather than later.
So do I. It's been a little while between drinks, so we do need to sort that out. I will talk to you soon, Kathy. Thank you.
Lovely.
So much.
Thanks, Natasha.
Take care.
See you later. Bye. Big thanks for investing your time right through to the end of this episode of Private Practice Secrets. We hope you enjoyed this episode and all the other strong private practice stories in this, our very first season of Private Practice Secrets. If you're keen for some more private practice business info, we sure can help you out. Head on over to the nakerconsulting.com.au website, and you'll find all sorts of bits and pieces there. Blogs, forms, web events, freebies, conferences, and more. I'll spell that for you, nacre.com.au. Yeah, a weird name with a really, really cool story. While you're on the website, you are warmly invited to book in for a free 30-minute power coaching session. I really look forward to hearing a bit more about you and your business. And yes, you have full permission to pick my brains. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathy Love, Allied Health Business Coach, and I'm wishing you and your business a brilliant day.